Succession number 27083, reel 78.
So Henry, you were talking about China.
Well, China is an increasingly unknown quantity, but...
Do you think so? Increasingly unknown? I would have thought it's becoming increasingly known.
Well, if you ask me to predict what will be the course of future progress for the next 25 years with China, I'd be hard put to do it. They have, it's an extraordinary contradiction really, I think I've mentioned this before, they've got some, during what I actually saw during my visit to China, their space program, bang up to date, their actual service hardware, pretty crude and pretty obsolescent. It won't go on like that necessarily forever. And nobody, bear in mind, has predicted the course of the next war correctly yet, and I wouldn't boast that I'm an exception to that. But I quote that because they have an enormous population, enormous resources, enormous, they might not believe it, enormous inherent wealth, and they are communist, which is a different philosophy from the rest of the world, pretty well the rest of the world. So what are they going to do? And I would merely say that I think that the retention of an independent nuclear deterrent, which we currently have, is money very well spent and is likely to go on being so as far ahead as I can reasonably foresee.
And I would ask, is Trident now the best form? I don't, shall we say, for the purpose of our conversation today, dispute at all that we need a nuclear deterrent, but is Trident the best type of deterrent? Would it not be better, for example, to have nuclear cruise missiles, for example? In other words, with low yield, so that if you have a rogue state, whoever it may be, you don't want to wipe them off the face of the map with a Trident missile, you have a very low yield missile. Or is that argument incorrect?
I think it is a tenable argument up to a point. But I think where it comes unstuck is that you're talking of the deterrent in terms of its usage. And by having a massive overkill, if you like, for the little state, you are talking in terms of deterrence. And we are still in the business of deterrence. And that is the ultimate fallback for this country with that capability. And I think it's likely to go on being that for the foreseeable future. So I would hold to the big, the massive Trident on grounds of deterrence. A few little hard-tipped missiles, even if intercontinental, is scaling the whole thing down. Whereas the prospect of massive destruction, oblivion, if you like, must be more effective as a deterrent.
Against rogue states?
Against rogue states. And against, well, how big is the rogue?
Yes, I was thinking of Gaddafi's Libya. He's allegedly, of course, changed his spots, but
does the leopard really do that?
But does the leopard really do that? But, you know, I was thinking of him as a good example, or any of those countries that exist in the old Soviet Union, which either have access to ex-Soviet Union
stuff,
yeah. or could obtain it if they did a bit of careful negotiations with their neighbours. I just wonder whether. If they have a facility, for example, The Iraqis had their nuclear facility, which the Israelis attacked 20, 25 years ago, whether if you really wanted to obliterate that, you could do it with a very low-yield nuclear missile and say, this is what will happen if you try and build an illegal nuclear facility. We will knock it out, and here is an example of how we'll do it. You can't do that with Trident, and it's quite difficult to do it with conventional.
I agree with your last two remarks. I think this is a matter of what inevitably becomes a fairly subjective judgment. For my money, I think that there is sufficient proliferation of some nuclear capability or neo-proliferation that it has become, to that extent, something of a commonplace. Trident is not a commonplace, and I don't think it's likely to become one for, as I say, as far as I can think ahead. And therefore, in terms of scaring the wits out of so-and-so, of whatever size so-and-so may be, I don't think the former would. And a couple of extra trots might give him Dutch courage, and he'd give it a go and call the bluff and so forth. But I think the prospect of, I go back to the word oblivion, near oblivion, I think that gives him much more serious pause for thought. That's where I would place my bet. Not everybody would agree. And it's expensive. But I think it'll be a sad day if we start to say, as you were hypothetically postulating, that we no longer have a discernible threat, therefore we no longer need an independent nuclear deterrent. That's really the operative word. So let us save a great deal of money, and we can have so many more ships or regiments or clever aircraft or this or that, because it is an expensive facility. I think it is money well spent.
Yes, and it would also, I think, if one were to get rid of the nuclear deterrent eventually, it would have an effect on our... it's no coincidence that the five permanent members of the Security Council are all major nuclear powers. There are other minor nuclear powers now, unfortunately, but I think that it would certainly, if we were to get rid of it, I think it would affect our... it would start
our standard.
Yeah.
Yes, it would, I think.
And people would start to ask, well, you know, should you be on the Security Council as a permanent member, given that you've clearly taken this particular direction with your defence spending?
Yeah, I agree. Could I go on? There's just one more that I think I ought to mention in terms of why do we need a navy? And that is, it's a rather okay phrase that's come to the fore in fairly recent years, power projection overseas. Now, I don't want to quote scenarios here, but we are an island nation, whereas a great deal can be done by air. Sooner or later, something, whether in terms of backup supply or even the initial assault, if that's what we're going to go in for, almost certainly has to be done by sea. I'm not suggesting for a second that we can take on the world, because we can't, and do it on our own. So all these things, apart from the independent deterrent, but maintenance of the freedom of the seas, power protection overseas, would be in conjunction with, in collaboration with, some other country or countries. And I see that as a primary continuing role of the Navy. The final point I would make, I think, and this is not so much why have a Navy, but what form the Navy should take, which is really rather a different thing, is that it's very easy for experts, in quotes, to say, ah, my dear fellow, the likely course of the next war is, and they've never got it right yet, but nevertheless they can say that. And they can say, as clever people, and they were clever people, said that there'd never be a thing like the Falklands War. It would always be done by nuclear submarines and maritime patrol aircraft in the Iceland Faroes gap. And they were thinking in terms of Russia, of course. Perhaps we should be thinking in terms of what the Chinese might get up to, and so on. But my point is that if you so emasculate the general capability of a service, we're talking of the Navy now, but it applies to any service, because of you base that on an explicit, distinct scenario in isolation, you are in for trouble. And you need to maintain as much general capability and as much flexibility as you judge you can afford. It'll always be a compromise. You'd always like to go for so-and-so, but then you find it's rather like a hospital. If it doesn't update its, say, its theatre facilities, then it'll quite quickly run out of business. It'll be overtaken by other hospitals, and it'll fall behind, and finally it'll collapse. And so if we don't keep up to date with various advances, to the extent that we judge we can afford them, which is quite a considerable extent, or if, in order to save cost, we say, right, what's the submarine threat? There isn't one. So let's not bother with anti-submarine capability. And once you have lost a capability over a period of time, it will take a much longer period of time to recover that capability, if indeed you're able to do so. So flexibility is in a rather different context, not why you have a navy, but broadly the shape of the navy. Keep flexible. Otherwise you'll find you back the wrong horse. Could I end by commenting on two things? The first is, and I'll use the vulgar colloquial term, jointery. The great fashion today is for everything to be joint. The staff colleges have all combined into one, and it's joint. They've trimmed them. It's a very fine building, it's a very fine thing. And the idea is that young officers should be brought up with a considerable knowledge of the other two services, in addition to knowledge of their own. It has, frankly, got out of hand. It's an admirable thing to go for. It's an admirable target if kept within bounds. And it's now got to the stage when it is almost beyond bounds. And for the sake of jointery, anything goes. And the reason I say that is that there's nothing clever about having three services. It's grown, it's evolved. The Royal Air Force was the last in the field to have its own independence, so to speak, because there were no such things as flying machines before, so this is understandable. It'd be perfectly possible to have an air element of the Army and an air element of the Navy. I don't think that is likely, and I wouldn't even advocate it. And the reason I wouldn't is that in my experience, which is to an extent overtaken by time, now, but in my experience, it is quite hard work, it's very hard work, to, at the various levels, to train, and I'm talking largely of officers, but it goes right through down to all levels, to train an individual for the particular job in the appointment that he's going to be put to next. You train him, you then appoint him. In that appointment, he practices that element of his trade. At the end of that appointment, you have to train him in some broader field, or some different field, or some higher field, and then he gets a higher appointment, and so on, and it's a progression. And it is difficult enough to do that individual single service training to the required level of expertise, which is extreme, and have anything approaching as detailed an expertise in the business of either of the other two services. An obvious, a not very fair case in point is flying. And flying is a young man's game, and it has to be. Otherwise, the whole system can't stand the G factor and so on. But I think I've got the message over. In my judgment, you want to be very careful that you don't get so over-enthusiastic on jointery that you lose that edge of expertise, which is the only reason you have a separate service. And we are in real risk today of going beyond that.
Now, every year, perhaps more frequently than once a year, you meet your fellow ex-chiefs, and you meet the current First Sea Lord once a year. To what extent do you think your opinions, which you've just expressed on jointry, are reciprocated among your recently ex-former chiefs and among the present one, or present ones, if you like?
I think you'll find, and you're talking of people, I was about to say, use the phrase thinking people, but at the level you say, I like to hear they're all thinking people. I think you'll find that is general. I think it has gone most, I think, would agree that it has gone to the limit. I would actually say it has gone a bit beyond the limit already. But you may come back at me and say, well, you're old hat, you're out of touch, you don't really know anymore what you're talking about. And just because it wasn't like that in your day, you think it's wrong. Well, you can hold that view if you wish. But that is my opinion, and I think you'll find it is quite generally shared.
Well, you see, I wouldn't dream of suggesting the first thing which you've just said, but I will pick you up on something that is generally shared. If it's generally shared, and it's generally shared by the active chiefs today and their immediate predecessors who've just retired, for example, why is it still being pursued? Is the imperative towards jointry so politically motivated and so financially motivated that the chiefs don't think they can do anything about it? Is that the reason why it happens?
I think you're very close to hitting the nail on the head. Yes.
So there's more politicians again?
Yes.
Right. Okay.
You think that I have perhaps rather repetitively throughout this narrative had a go at politicians, and you could argue that politicians are just another section of the community doing their job. And they would have most esoteric definitions as to what their job is, I'm sure. But yes, I think that that's what's driven it. And don't think that I'm being over parochial, you probably do think that. I don't mean it that way. I'm all for a considerable, and much more than existed in my early days, I'm all for, John Turay, to a sensible extent.
The appropriate amount.
We've exceeded the level of good sense.
Now this leads me, I know you have one other point which we'll come on to if we may in a moment, but this seems opportune to raise another point I have, which is that, which is something I raised with Peter Hill Norton and with other chiefs that I've spoken to, and that is that so much of your time as a professional serviceman, especially once you reach flag rank and its equivalent in the other services, is taken up with dealing with, if you like, political small p matters and politicians large p. And do you think that you get enough training to deal with what you call the zoo and the political life that is involved? Do you think that the way the Navy is organized and the way that one's progression from junior flag rank to first sea lord gives you enough training during that period for dealing with what you have to deal with?
It's a matter of degree, of course. I personally think that the answer is yes. I was lucky, if you like, that's how I regard it, in that for all my flag jobs and indeed my senior captain's jobs alternated between the zoo in one form or another or sea command. And that's how I would have wished it. Now there were many more around then, very fine shore establishments that would have been great fun to have commanded, but you wouldn't have been an integral part of the mechanism of really running the shop to the same extent. The influence that particularly at the lower levels you could have applied would have been significantly less, whereas you were influencing, you weren't controlling of course, but you were influencing events in terms of advice to others and battles and so forth, and you were in amongst it in Whitehall, and I don't think that you required, if you were going to be a success and if you were going to go to the top, you didn't require more or more specific training in that area. I don't think you had enough already.
Right. Okay. That is that's an interesting view. Certainly, one of the chiefs of the air staff I've spoken to, whilst he would not, I don't think, specifically agree with what I've just said, certainly felt that he became chief of the air staff. Naive is too strong a word. He was ill prepared for the bruising encounters that took place during his period.
You tell me his name, though.
I'm happy to tell you his name. because, I mean, he's on the tape, so so you can find him. No, it's Michael Graydon.
I wasn't thinking of him. I don't know terribly well. I've met him just.
He's a bit after your time.
He was after my time.
92 to 97, 4.5 years.
Yes. Which is too long.
Which may be too long. He found that his bruising encounters, so it's all on the tape, so it's not secret, with Malcolm Rifkind and Kenneth Clark. He found himself ill-prepared, perhaps isn't quite the right word, but he was unready for what he had to deal with. He found it extremely difficult. It was a vertiginous learning curve.
Yes, well,
there
is a view. It's not my view, actually.
I'm not suggesting that chiefs should go off and do a degree in political science with Peter Hennessy in the chair, so to speak, as the as the chief tutor.
Yeah, yeah.
But I sometimes wonder that you're up against people who's for whom deviousness, manipulativeness, is part and parcel of the trade, which I don't think it is for the great majority of servicemen.
Well, there I would take some issue with you.
Ah, right.
You qualify that by saying for the great majority. Perhaps that is so, in which case the great majority is not destined for the top, and that's true, they're not. And they shouldn't go to the top. Of course, you have to, I don't want to nitpick here, but you have to discriminate between deviousness and manipulation and all that stuff with dishonesty.
Yes, with duplicity.
And you should, in my judgment, you will never actually, unless you're extremely fortunate, you will not get away with dishonesty. You start lying and you'll be rumbled. And I'm very happy to keep it that way. You can be as devious as you like. You can manipulate to the limit of your ability or beyond, even. And that's fair game. And that is what I would describe as Whitehall politics, because you are dealing with politicians. And don't tell me that any politician is going to get anywhere without an extremity of deviousness.
Well, that's my point. Yes. 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 All right. I have one further question, which goes back to power projection overseas. I'll happily address it now. Would you like to deal with your last point? Which would you like to take first?
Well, I've forgotten what I was going to talk about.
Ah.
I wrote down the word resources. And I don't know what sparked that. Something you said, I think.
Then perhaps it does come on with my question here. Perhaps if I raise this question, it will assist you, Sir Henry. You used the expression earlier, power projection overseas, as one of the third prong for the basic reason
yep.
for having a navy. Do you think the present fleet's able to execute what the government is requiring of it? The present fleet is arranged, and this decision to build two new carriers, which only in the paper yesterday, this is the 10th of June, it looks as if the Defence Secretary has signed an agreement with his French counterpart to include French design and planning in the arrangement, and the French will buy one as well, so there'll be three new carriers to be built.
Yes, I wasn't sure of the timescale of that. I read that with interest too, and I thought, well, here we go again with the French. By which I mean the shifty French, although I got some very good, used to have some very good friends there. And I don't know why we bang on with the French like this. You come back to money, you see. Anything to do it on the cheap. You try that with the French, and sooner or later they will have their way. And you risk that at your peril. There's too much at stake, I think. But in terms of power projection, I think this is, as seen today, this is a sensible move forward. It's not emasculating the head of the rest of the Navy at all. All the Air Force come to that. It will add a capability which is somewhat foreshortened now, and still more over the intervening years until 2012, in terms of support for the Army when they have deployed. So I'm in favour of those two. I'm not in favour. I do not support the criticisms of Admiral Lula Bailey, who wrote a letter to the Times, you may have read, saying, we don't want these two great things, we need more little ones. And he was supported very largely by a man who I admire tremendously. This was Professor Sir Lawrence Martin, a very fine historian and a very balanced writer. And he was rather supporting Lulu Bailey. I'm afraid I don't. I think they got it wrong.
Well, Sir Henry, thank you for your comments on that and on the question of the suitability of the two carriers as against other ships. I see that we're virtually at the end of this side of this tape. I'll just switch over and we have just a couple more points to cover, which I think will then conclude us.